Hi, and welcome to the Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on City of East Chicago firefighters testing positive for COVID-19. The president of the American Federation of Teachers brought muscle and money in support of a referendum to raise taxes in the Gary Community School Corp. Indiana mail-in ballots must be returned to the county election administrator's office by noon on election day if they're going to count. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Carol Williams, assistant director for the Hammond Public Library. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. An East Chicago firefighter recently tested positive for COVID-19. The East Chicago Professional Firefighters Local 365 released a statement on behalf of its membership outlining the details of the interaction between the unnamed firefighter and the East Chicago Fire Department Administration. In the statement, it is alleged that on September 29th, the fire department was made aware by the unnamed firefighter while on his scheduled shift that a member within their household tested positive for COVID-19. According to the press release, the fire department advised the firefighter to continue working the rest of their shift and was told to, quote, segregate from the fire crew and to wear a mask. The unnamed firefighter began having symptoms of COVID-19 and subsequently tested positive a few days later. The East Chicago Professional Firefighters Local 365 assert the fire station and the fire engine that the infected firefighter was stationed at was not decontaminated until 2 days later. The firefighters who work in direct contact with the infected firefighter were contacted by the City of East Chicago on October 2nd to be tested but were not quarantined. The City of East Chicago COVID-19 policy exempts firefighters from the CARES Act. The Times reports City Attorney Carla Morgan says the city's practices are keeping up with CDC guidelines, which allows firefighters with exposure to return to work once they get tested while wearing a mask at all times. On October 10th, 8 additional firefighters received notifications from the Indiana State Department of Health that they all tested positive for COVID-19.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson.
The president of the American Federation of Teachers brought muscle and money in support of a referendum to raise taxes in the Gary Community School Corp. Randy Weingarten presented a check to lead manager Paige McNulty Tuesday morning during a barnstorming ATF stop in Gary to support the referendum and encourage people to vote in the November 3rd election. The Post-Tribune reports the ATF bus tour began September 30th in California and is making its way across the country. In Gary, Weingarten said the stakes were high on the local as well as national level. She goes on to say, when cities like Gary were abandoned by businesses and corporations, the state had a duty to fill the breach when schools lost money. Instead, she said, Indiana created privatization, diverting more money out of traditional public schools. Under former GOP governors Mitch Daniels and Mike Pence, Indiana created the most expansive voucher system in the nation. National ATF President Weingarten commended Gary's ATF President Gleneva Dunham, who's also the state ATF president, for working with McNulty to promote the 8-year, $71.2 million referendum that will mean a 52-cent tax increase per $100 assessed valuation for homeowners. McNulty said Geary needs the referendum to keep up with neighboring communities. Last year, she said the district was short 45 teachers because it had not offered raises in more than 10 years. Joined by Democratic gubernatorial candidate Dr. Woody Myers and running mate Linda Lawson, 1st Congressional District candidate Frank Mervan, as well as other Democratic candidates, Weingarten encouraged voters to line up behind candidates who support coronavirus relief funding, scientifically informed education plans, and increased funding for the nation's most socioeconomically disadvantaged districts. Lawson, a former Hammond School Board member for 12 years, critiqued the state support of virtual schools and promised to bring changes to education funding if elected. Mervan, who served 15 years as North Township trustee, offered his support of Myers and Lawson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb will not reimpose any COVID-19 restrictions despite all of the state's guiding principles heading in the wrong direction. Hospitalizations are at levels not seen since May. The average number of new cases has jumped 82% since Holcomb rescinded almost all restrictions. The positivity rate has increased 32% in that time. And some hospital systems are experiencing staffing shortages. But Holcomb stresses the need for personal responsibility.
This ultimately comes down to our personal actions or inactions.
Holcomb says the state is focused on providing support to local communities that experience spikes in cases.
Just like everything else we do around here, we have to look at the root causes. And assuming that some blanket response will solve it, that's being proven inaccurate.
Holcomb points to similar COVID surges around the country and the world.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana mail-in ballots must be returned to the County Election Administrator's Office by noon on Election Day, November 3rd. If they're going to count. That's after a federal appeals court Tuesday reinstituted the state's vote-by-mail deadline. Common Cause Indiana and the Indiana NAACP sued the state earlier this year trying to get that mail-in ballot deadline extended. They argued, with the pandemic increasing vote by mail and slowing down the post office, the deadline would leave thousands of ballots uncounted. A federal district court judge agreed. But now, the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals overturned that decision. In its ruling, the appellate court says it's the responsibility of voters, not the state, to do everything they can to ensure their vote is counted. The appeals court decision also says it doesn't want to change election policies this close to Election Day.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A recent report says school funding gaps between students based on income status and race are widening under Indiana's state funding model. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay explains the report also makes recommendations to change course.
The report says spending gaps between wealthier and low-income schools are getting bigger, largely because changes state lawmakers have made to the school funding formula in the past decade. Claire Fidian Green is CEO of the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation, which commissioned the study. She says changes made in 2015 has meant schools spend even less on low-income kids.
Since 2015, the overall per-pupil funding level for students from low-income households has dropped by 35%.
But the analysis did come with a set of recommendations. Fidian Green says the most critical is for the state to distribute funding based on a community's local wealth. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
2020 might represent the best chance Indiana Democrats have had in two decades to win the race for Attorney General. And if they do, one of the biggest factors will be a person who's not even a part of the general election campaign, incumbent AG Curtis Hill. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brendan Smith reports on how Hill still impacts the race and where the two candidates stand on the campaign's other major issues.
The Indiana Supreme Court temporarily suspended Curtis Hill's law license on May 11th for criminally battering four women, effectively ending a two-year saga. 2 months later, Indiana Republican state convention delegates chose former Secretary of State Todd Rokita over Hill to be their 2020 nominee for Attorney General. But Hill's impact was still felt on, for instance, the Democratic candidate, former Evansville Mayor Jonathan Weinzappel.
Frankly, it starts and ends with Curtis Hill. For the most part, I got into this race thinking I was going to be running against Curtis Hill, right?
Rokita got into the race at the last minute and says he wanted to make sure Republicans chose the candidate with the best chance to win.
I'm running for Attorney General because we need strong leadership at a time like this.
Both candidates also use Hill as a contrast to how they'd run the Attorney General's office. Pretty similarly, too. Here's Rokita.
I would hope that there wouldn't be a distraction. Right. And you can't deny the fact that, you know, there's obviously a lot of distraction in the office when the head of your office is under such a cloud.
And Weinzappel.
I had the opportunity to talk to some former deputy attorney generals. You know, what they have told me is that, you know, his ethical issues have been a huge distraction.
Curtis Hill is also a big reason why this race is so competitive. National groups targeted it as a potential pickup for Democrats because of the current AG's misconduct. Still, political scientist Andrew Downs says Hill isn't the central figure anymore, which helps fellow Republican Rokita.
So many things are happening right now that are of huge importance that we can forget things faster than we used to be able to forget them.
One of those important things? The future of healthcare access. Indiana, led by Curtis Hill, is part of a lawsuit to eliminate the Affordable Care Act, the federal healthcare law that, among other things, protects access for people with pre-existing conditions. Weinzappel would pull Indiana out of that lawsuit, even as he acknowledges doing so now would be largely symbolic.
Killing the ACA would have a profound impact on Hoosiers. We're talking about 2.7 million who have some type of pre-existing condition. Right, whether that's high blood pressure, diabetes, a positive test for coronavirus.
Rokita supports the lawsuit and efforts to tear down the ACA, but...
To be clear, I am for covering people with pre-existing conditions. I would be for and would help the General Assembly make sure that pre-existing conditions were covered.
There's also COVID-19. Both candidates want to use the Attorney General's Consumer Fraud Division to help protect Hoosiers from scams that have erupted around the pandemic. On police reform, the two diverge. Rokita.
The first question we have to ask is what's being taught right now? Oh, reform this and reform that and no, don't do this anymore, but do this all the time. That's just a political decision.
And Weinzappel.
I think we ought to start with what the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus has put on the table. I think there are some good ideas there.
Andrew Downs says the AG's race will likely also tell us something else, something larger, about Indiana Democrats' decades-long strategy of running moderate, centrist candidates statewide.
This is a moment to ask ourselves, is that a profile that is now broken completely, or does it still work in certain situations?
The campaign for Attorney General will likely be the closest statewide race in Indiana this year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Hammond Public Library Assistant Director Carol Williams.
We've been checking from time to time with some of the public libraries here in Northwest Indiana as they're dealing with the COVID-19 health crisis. Let's find out more in particular about the Hammond Public Library. And with us from the Hammond Public Library, we have Assistant Director Carol Williams. Carol, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Well, bring us up to date, if you will, first about how the library had to deal with a sudden shutdown back in the spring months here after as the pandemic was really, really gripping us hard. What was the impact on immediately, at least, on the Hammond Public Library?
Well, like all organizations, it came as a complete shock. We weren't prepared in advance for what was going to happen since, it really was unprecedented. We closed our doors for March 17th, which was a Tuesday. We were open on the Monday, business as usual, and when we got the word that we were going to be closing, all of our librarians were scrambling to take home as many items, materials that they possibly could so that they could work from home. So our youth librarians were taking home stacks and stacks of storybooks to work on programming from home. Our adult and teen librarians were, taking home craft supplies and books for online book discussions and all that stuff. We shut down. We were holding meetings virtually with each other from home to try to plan things out. Lots of extensive phone calls to get something, planned and working. And we were able to start using Facebook and videos of getting online programs. So even though our doors were closed for those roughly 2 months, we were still able to provide some sort of programming and interaction with the public.
Now, obviously, during that time that you were physically closed, you had the opportunity, I suppose, to take a look at what all the safety guidelines would be so you could try to reopen the building and probably had to do a lot of retooling and refitting like all the other libraries, right?
A lot of that, yes. Yeah. And as things, were being known publicly about the virus and all of that, we had to constantly be changing our plans based on, what all of the experts were saying.
Would you have any idea how many times you had to change things around before you finally got to stay on one particular guideline?
Well, that's easier said than done, yeah. Because even once we reached the stage where we opened, things, the governor was changing his orders. We were moving back and forth into different stages, especially here in Lake County, and we had to adjust mid-stride. But our staff has been fabulous in readjusting themselves and how they work throughout the day to adjust to, the ups and downs of this thing.
Now, bring us up to date, at least physically, what all had to be changed within the Hammond Public Library. It's probably very similar to many of the other public libraries around Lake County and mm-hmm. the region as well, but it may have had to do some specific things because you have a specific building.
Yes. For a time, we limited, we have two entrances, one on the east and the west side of our buildings. For a time, we limited that only to the main entrance on our east side, simply because we could better manage the flow of traffic and keep people, keep them in their lanes as they're coming in and out. So contact was reduced. So that was difficult to get used to. Currently, though, both of our entrances are open, so we've got a good control over the flow now. But we've had to move furniture numerous times. Like other locations around the county, we've had to put the markings on the floor. We've got plexiglass plates in front of all of our public desks. So the staff that have to work at those desks and go face-to-face with the public, we've got that extra added protection for both the patron and the staff.
Now, you mentioned that early on here, in fact, almost as soon as you found out that you had to make the shutdown very quick, and you said librarian staff members were taking things home to be able to do things from home. Mm-hmm. Were these a lot of things that were in the works, like summer reading programs and activity programs and the like, that you had to at least try and, if you thought that you could reopen fairly soon, that you could be able to get back in place?
Well, we're not that far ahead into summer reading, but definitely the programs that were scheduled for the remainder of March mm-hmm. and April, our librarians plan months in advance for their programs, so they knew what the topics were, what materials that they were going to use. So instead of keeping them on hand in a programming room, they took them all home with them.
Now, tell us, for people here in Northwest Indiana that may not know, when did the Hammond Public Library get to reopen here after the shutdown?
I believe that, you know, each library needs to do what's best for their community. We reopened earlier than many of the libraries did. We reopened to the public on Tuesday, May 26th, so right after Memorial Day. We opened with very limited services. It was first floor access only. We had a patron limit of only 20 people at a time in the building. And it was basically pick up your materials or request materials, and you had a 30-minute computer use limit, and then that was it. But primarily what we found was people needed access to the copy machine to make important copies. They needed to fax things, and they were just so relieved that, oh, my God, I've got somewhere I can go to get this done. I've been stuck at home for months. And though they were very appreciative, even with the limited services that we could offer when we first reopened.
We're talking with Carol Williams. She's the assistant director of the Hammond Public Library about how the library in downtown, historic downtown Hammond, has been coping with the coronavirus pandemic. The changes had to be made and getting the library reopened. And now, the programs that normally happen during the summer, I know where lots of people come in and out of the building, obviously were limited. What programs were you able to accomplish once we were able to reopen there on May 26th?
Mm-hmm. Our programming online, you know, the programs that they could do online continued on. Our actual in-person programming didn't resume until August, but that still left a big gap for us during June and July, which are, for all libraries, those are your peak months, especially for children.
Yeah.
And so we took a big hit on our summer reading. We had much fewer people participating. But what we did differently this year because of COVID is we developed take-home kits. So when we knew that there was a program on the schedule, we put the word out there that, okay, if you want your kids to participate from home for this particular program, let us know how many of these kits you need, make arrangements to come and pick them up, and then your children could participate in the program virtually from home because we would provide you all of the necessary items for the program.
Were you able to do any type of a summer reading programs, or even if it had to be done virtually, or at least set up virtually?
Well, the overall, you know, initiative for keeping up with reading during the summer, last year we started using a program called Beanstack. And so you manage your, you know, your library reading and recording of your books through this app. It's also available on the computer. So many of the families were already familiar with using it from the previous year. So we were using that. We were planning on using that for this past summer anyway. So for many families, there wasn't any interruption because they were already using this. But the biggest obstacle was browsing for the books that your family likes to read.
I see. Yeah. Well, now we get into, of course, now, what programs are underway now that you're back in? Are you not almost but not quite at the normal stage, such as it is?
Well, we have resumed normal programming. We are continuing our virtual programming. It is, you know, a weird situation. There's many people who still don't feel comfortable coming to a program with a lot of strangers, and we understand that. So we're not scheduling as many in-person programs as we used to. You know, hopefully as this thing rides itself out over time, you know, we'll be able to resume that heavier calendar. But we do still offer in-person programs, and for many of our programs, there is an online component. So maybe if we record it, you can watch it from home, either live streamed or in an archive fashion from either the Facebook or our YouTube channel.
Well, that's great to hear. Now, you mentioned early on here that many of the patrons that rely on the library to be able to copy off important documents or fax out materials were happy when the library was able to reopen. What's been the general reaction from Hammond Public Library patrons, especially about being able to reopen so quickly, so to speak?
Well, we get a lot of, I didn't realize you guys were open, or how long have you been open? Because so many things for so long were shut down, they just assumed we were as well. Even though we tried to get the word out, letting them know that, you know, we were open in a limited capacity for this time. You know, we were open back to full use, you know, at a later time. A lot of surprise and a lot of gratitude that, hey, now I have somewhere I can go and do this. You know, the people that are coming to use our study rooms and our computers are just very grateful to have this, you know, this outlet.
Well, Carol, thank you very much for the great information. We're glad to hear that the Hammond Public Library is moving back in towards the at least the new normal, as it may be.
Yeah.
And hopefully it's been a benefit, not only of learning process for everybody with the COVID-19 pandemic, but also for the community as well, to be able to know that the library's been able to come bounce back and be back in service as quickly as much as it has. And we thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about it.
Thank you for having us.
Carol Williams is the Assistant Director of the Hammond Public Library.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.